Go to the National Archives website. They'll give you all the information you need to get to these libraries, and please achieve to reach that goal, that seal of the presidential seal, which is crystal, which is great.
This is Steve Sherlock with another Franklin Matters radio show, number 731 in the series. This session of the radio show shares the presentation and talk titled Love Letters to the Presidents. Franklin's own State Rep Jeff Roy presented at the Franklin Historical Museum on Sunday, February 13, 2022, to a full house. Jeff shared his adventures as he traveled to each of the presidential libraries and museums. A link to the presentation doc is included in the show notes. The recording runs about an hour and 53 minutes, so let's sit back, relax, and join Jeff on his journey to the presidential museums. Note, I think you should be able to follow along. While he doesn't provide page numbers, he does talk to a number of the photos and identifies which one each is on a page.
Okay, so it's almost 2:15.
Well, if it's 2:15, we're all in trouble.
1:15. A few minutes ago, I asked my husband what time it was, and he said, it's 2:11, and it's been in my head since. So no, it was 1:11. It is now almost 1:15.
Thank you for pointing that out.
So thank you all for coming out on this beautiful, sunny, warm day. Oh, wait, sorry, that was yesterday. On this snowy day, thank you for making your way out. And I think the roads seemed all right. Thank you to the town, who did such a fabulous job. And we got here at 11:45, and there were two sand trucks in the driveway. They shoveled the sidewalks were plowed. So I'm telling you, you complain enough, and people will jump. thank you all for being here. Yes? Oh, thank you all for being here. I know that our speaker does not need an introduction, and he's got a fabulous presentation, so I am not going to waste any more time with my song and dance. I will introduce...
But I want to hear the song.
I know. Another time. So, Mr. State Rep Jeffrey Roy.
Well, Mary, thank you so much, and thank you, everyone, for being such hearty souls. I like to remind people that we do live in Massachusetts in the Northeast, and it does have occasion to snow, but life still goes on, so I'm glad that we have so many hearty souls. I am so excited to be here and pregame with you. I'm so glad the Patriots are not in, because I guarantee we would not have the folks who are here today. We are not serving hors d'oeuvres, we are not serving cocktails. We'll save that for, I'm going to a place at 5 o'clock, so it's 5 o'clock somewhere. But this is affectionately called Love Letters to Presidents, and it's only called Love Letters to Presidents because we are here the day before Valentine's Day, and I'm so glad that I have so many Valentines in my life. But when I thought of presidential libraries and the museums and archives that we build to honor our presidents, it really does seem to fit the theme of a love letter, because these buildings and these monuments and museums really talk about and give presidents an opportunity to tell the stories in their own words about what they went through. And for me, having lived through many of these experiences, and historically the presidential libraries cover the time period 1928 to today, but all but one of the presidents that I'll be talking about today in their libraries were alive at some point in my lifetime. The only one who had died before I was born was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, but every other one of them was here and alive, so that makes it interesting. This is my favorite photo. I'll tell you the story about how this photo came to be when we get to Jimmy Carter, but I just want to begin and say that, you know, before the mid-20th century, presidential papers and effects were generally understood to be private property of the presidents. And you may have read this week that there is still a president that believes that those are his private property. And the National Archives stepped in and said, no, those belong to the American people. So I think there's a shipment on the way from Mar-a-Lago to the National Archives. But Franklin Delano Roosevelt was the first president who came into being to propose to leave those papers to the public in a building donated by him on his Hyde Park estate in New York. It's only about 3 hours from where we are. And that was the first library that I really visited and really got me excited about this project. And he had established a way to keep these documents in a presidential library system. And they promote, and I also want to let you know, this is the first time I'm doing this talk, so you're going to be some of my guinea pigs to see if it's too long, if it's too short, and what I cover. But these presidential libraries, they really promote the American experience and talk about what we have experienced. They bring together articles and historical materials. They actually support research, and they create programs that folks can enjoy at these particular libraries. So you're looking at the FDR Library in Hyde Park, New York, and below that is the JFK Library in Boston. We are fortunate to have one of them right here in our state. So again, these were conceived by FDR, and this is actually the building under construction. And I like to share what he said. Let me see if I can expand it on my screen. And he spoke at the dedication of his library. He was the only president to actually use his library as an office while he was still the president. All of the other libraries were built after the folks left. So he said, the dedication of a library is in itself an act of faith. To bring together the records of the past and to house them in buildings where they will be preserved for the use of men and women in the future, a nation must believe in three things. It must believe in the past, it must believe in the future, and it must, above all, believe in the capacity of its own people so to learn from the past that they can gain in judgment in creating their own future. And I can't think of a better way to describe what a presidential library and museum is all about. And that's how it got its start. After FDR did it, it was all private donations. In 1955, Congress institutionalized the policy through the Presidential Libraries Act, and that was amended again in 1986. And how these work is the president, once they leave office, they have to raise private funds. Those private funds build the library. It gets to be as big as that president is able to raise money. And then once it's built, then it gets turned over to the federal government. The National Archives then runs that as a part of its system. Some libraries take a little longer to get a part of that system. I would say the Richard Nixon Library took until, I believe it was 2007, 2008, to become a part of the system. President Obama's library, we're not sure how long it's going to take for that to become a part of the national system, because he has differences of opinion as to how things should run in that library. These are pages of American history. And every single day, presidents and their staff, they generate thousands of documents that deal with our nation. And the libraries, they preserve these official records. They preserve the personal papers of the president's family members, associates, and friends. And enriching these documents and making them available to the people who are the owners of these documents and materials are what these libraries are all about. And they also include films, they include audio that you can go in and listen to. And I will say, it's history at your fingertips. And it's not just boring presidential documents and research, you actually get a look at some of the gifts that were given to these presidents, and you're looking at some of the stuff that Richard Nixon got from China. All the presidents love baseball, and every museum has something devoted to baseball. I found that one to be cool, signed by five presidents. And you'll actually, many of them are near the childhood homes of our presidents, and so you get to see how they grew up. And beyond history, these libraries serve a public purpose in that they bring special events. What you're looking at, I remember going to the Kennedy Library to see the dedication of the stamp honoring President Kennedy just a few years ago. Got to ride a horse in the Ronald Reagan Museum next to the dear president. And if you look at the photographs on the left, that's actually a book talk. That's a book talk I went to amazingly in 2016. I was there just as the presidential election was really heating up. That was in, it was either March or April of 2016. And we went to the library to tour it, and they said, we have a book talk that's going to take place this evening if you'd like to come back. So I went back, and the book talk was on a book called 1924, The Year That Made Hitler. And I was like, this is amazing that I'm in a presidential library and this is what we're talking about. Fascinating. But those are the types of things that will happen. Most of them have auditoriums and facilities for folks to do these types of events. There are also classrooms of democracy. Kids can go and see and examine what happens in presidential life. What you see on the left is a picture from the cabinet room at the Gerald Ford Library, where kids will go in and do various exercises. The JFK Library has kids and classrooms coming in. In addition to the JFK Library, right next door to it is the Edward M. Kennedy Center for Civil Institute, and students can actually go in a living replica of the United States Senate and play the role of senators. So they're classrooms of democracy as well. So where are these libraries? They're all over the country. Some are located in convenient places, some not so convenient. Typically it's the president who gets to choose where the library is going to be. And the president, along with the United States archivist, they'll make the decision about where the presidential library will be built. And many have chosen their hometowns, and others have selected locations near a university campus. So it's easy to see the one in Boston. Pretty easy to see the ones in California. If you go to LA, you're within about an hour of each of them. Pretty easy to see those ones in Texas. Atlanta, not so bad. But I can tell you the Midwest journey, how many of you have ever been to Abilene, Kansas? All right, we have a few. Independence, Missouri. All right, well, that was a difficult one. But we figured it out. So this is the road show, and I see that my daughter Alicia has just arrived. I had announced to my family that I did want to do this Midwest road trip because it was six libraries that were not located in places that I thought I was ever going to get to for any business-related event. So I'm going to do it all in 1 week. Who wants to join me? Just about the same level of silence as I see in this room is what I heard at the kitchen table that evening. But Alicia volunteered and said, I will join you. And so Alicia and I flew to Iowa, Des Moines, right? Des Moines Airport, where we began our journey at West Branch, which is Herbert Hoover's home. Then we drove to Independence, Missouri to see Harry Truman, then snuck on over to Abilene, Kansas to see Dwight D. Eisenhower. We broke up our trip in Oklahoma City to visit some relatives and to see the federal museum memorial for the disaster that occurred there. And then we made our way down to Dallas, where we saw George W. Then we went to College Station to see George H.W. And we swung over to Austin to see LBJ's library. And that was in 7 days, 1,200 miles. And Alicia will tell you that I'm very strict on terms of the time. And we were up at 6 a.m. every morning. And we had to be on the road at a particular time. And there was even one point in the journey in Dallas, I got very sick from I asked for a very rare steak. I wanted an authentic Texas steak. And I said to the waiter, I said, I wouldn't mind if that thing walked to the table. I paid for it daily the next morning, but I said, Alicia, we have a schedule. I said, you are going to have to drive us from Dallas to College Station. And she ably made us the trip and got us there in time. So this is our journey in California, and I see my colleague, Representative Sean Garberly, is in the back of the room. He's the rep from Arlington. He's been hearing about these magical history tours for years. And he said, I'd like to join you on one of those tours. And he has joined me on several, but this is our journey in California. We actually started in San Diego and made it up to the Nixon Library, which is in Yorba Linda, and then Reagan's is up in Simi Valley. And we did spend a little time in Los Angeles, which is right in between the two museums. And then to see Little Rock, Arkansas, not a big shot on everybody's list, I'm sure, but Little Rock was a part of a civil rights tour that we took, going from Little Rock, Memphis, Nashville, and then we made it to Atlanta, where we saw the Jimmy Carter Library and Plains, Georgia, which I'll talk to you a little bit later. But that's how I organize these. The trips usually I see if I'm going somewhere for business or state business, and if it's a convention or something, if I can combine it. But never found a convention in Abilene, Kansas. So why visit? Well, in my business, leadership is something that is necessary to move people and to make decisions about public policies that affect everyone. And what better way to learn about leadership than to walk in the footpaths of those who have made it pretty well on the leadership scale. These folks have reached the pinnacle of political life in the United States of America, and as much as I've read books and seen movies and studied them in school, there's nothing like going and taking a trip to where they lived, where they did their work, and to develop that sense of empathy which is necessary to get a deeper understanding of what they went through. So I think that pretty much is the reason. And I can tell you, I took away many lessons from each of those journeys, and I'll try to talk about that today. So let's take a look at what's in these places. The Herbert Hoover. Now, I'm not going to tell you about them in order of how they came into being, because I told you that FDR was the one who conceived of these, and I immediately jumped to Herbert Hoover. Well, Herbert Hoover's library didn't come into being until the 60s, but he became part of the federal program and was made eligible as a president to have a library. Now, he was the 31st president of the United States. He was born in West Branch, Iowa, to a family of modest means, and he once was quoted as saying, "My country owes me nothing. It gave me as it gives every boy and girl a chance. In no other land could a boy from a country village without inheritance or influential friends look forward to unbounded help, unbounded hope." His father died in 1880 and his mother died in 1884, leaving him an orphan. But he went on to be president of the United States. He was When I was in school, the only thing I knew about Herbert Hoover was that the stock market crashed in 1929 and he was the worst president ever. But that's not really a fair portrayal of what he did and what his legacy is. And that's one of the things that presidential libraries give and provide of an opportunity to reflect the narrative of where they came from, what they did, and how they got to where they were. So he was known for feeding the world in World War I and gained the title of the great humanitarian as a result. He raised more than $1 billion back in 1918, $1 billion to feed Belgians during World War I, and often using his personal fortune as collateral. And once the Germany occupied the country, food imports were banned, and 10 million Belgians began to starve. And Herb Hoover created one of the first non-governmental organizations, NGOs, to locate and buy food, transport it overseas, and distribute it. He fed over 2.5 million youngsters in Belgium and France from 1914 to 1918. And that is honored and talked about in his museum, something I did not know before I got there. He was also the Commerce Secretary, and he exhorted American industry to standardize products ranging from milk bottles and auto tires to kitchen plumbing and gas meters. And by reducing manufacturing costs and boosting productivity, standardization created jobs and made it easier for do-it-yourselfers like myself to build a house or tighten a screw. And he preferred to concentrate on the practical benefits of commercial uniformity. Again, something I had no idea about until I got to that library. He won quite successfully in his race. He took over after Calvin Coolidge, a Massachusetts politician. Calvin Coolidge was, I love to share this story. When people come and take the tour at the State House, I say he was a school committee member, he was a town councilor in Northampton, he was a state representative, he was a state senator, he was a president of the Senate, he was a lieutenant governor, he was the governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, a vice president of the United States of America, and eventually the president of the United States of America. What a succession plan. But Hoover came in to take over for him in 1928, and Hoover was the first United States president to serve without taking a salary. The other was JFK and the former president, President Trump. Hoover also began construction of the Boulder Dam, later known as the Hoover Dam. And he was actually the one who, as an engineer, he came up with the idea to create an arch gravity dam in the Black Canyon of the Colorado River. And I like to say that the construction of this dam truly exemplifies for me what we do in government. Our role in government is to tame rivers. And the Hoover Dam tamed the Colorado River. And it was constructed between 1931 and 1936 during the Great Depression and was dedicated on September 30th, 1935 by President Roosevelt. It was only some years later that it was named after the man who formed it. I knew that before I went there, but it was interesting to see how it was portrayed in that particular library. Some other pieces that you could see, he was a prolific author. He had to stand for re-election in 1932. Things did not look good after what happened in 1929. And I think you all know what happened after that. And President Roosevelt took office in 1932. And President Hoover did not leave the scene. He lived for approximately 40 years. After, I believe it was 1964 that he passed away. He did most of his work out of the hotel room in the Waldorf Astoria, which you see in the top center photograph there. He's also buried on the grounds of his library next to his wife. And that's a common theme you see through these libraries. That is also the final resting place. But I was at this library with Alicia in 2016, and the thing that caught my attention was this particular letter. Is it going to allow me to make it bigger? So a young girl had written to President Hoover about the prospect of a woman becoming the president of the United States. I'm here in October 2016, and we came damn close to having the first woman be the president of the United States. But he said to her that he thinks it's fitting that in some time there will be a woman as a president of the United States. He does believe that the men have done a good job up to the date. But he said, with good wishes to you, if you are a candidate for president about 30 years hence and have improved fitness in the meantime, he was wishing her well. And I thought it was going to happen, but we also know what happened in 2016. So Franklin Delano Roosevelt, we did talk about Franklin Roosevelt being the first one, and it was built to hold his records. It's located on the grounds of Springwood, which is the Roosevelt family home and estate in Hyde Park, New York, Route 9, if you're looking for it. And it was built under the president's personal direction from 1939 to 1940, and it was dedicated on June 30th of 1941. This is an overview of the library and the museum, and Route 9 is off to the middle of the photograph. You can see the museum on the bottom right, and Roosevelt's family home is there on the left. It's all part of the museum and tour, and you can actually walk on through. Here is some shots from Roosevelt's home. He was a great collector of books. You can see where he slept. You can see the elevator that he had in his room. Although many people did not know it at the time, he was handicapped and was in a wheelchair. He walked with braces to see the driveway where he would walk with his braces to exercise himself from the Springwood family home all the way out to Route 9 and back is just incredible. And you know, you take that walk and that journey as a somewhat fit man, I can't imagine what it was like for him walking with the braces and crutches along that same journey. But that's something you can do out at that particular property. Interesting exhibits. I was fascinated by this chart up on the upper left, which shows the level of government spending versus the economy. And as you can see, the rating on the economy that they use in that chart is the unemployment rate. And you can see the unemployment rate in red is extremely high, but as government spending and the programs that FDR put in place go up, you can see the unemployment rate coming dramatically down. There is a slight dip in both, and you can see the unemployment rate went up relationally to government spending, and then it comes back. I know that political theorists will quarrel with that particular analysis, but I just show it as an example of the types of things that you'll see in these particular libraries. That office which is there, FDR was a micromanager and he selected everything. And in that particular room and where it was to go, and he was also a collector of stamps and books and more than 400 model ships, which are all in this particular library. If you go visit, on the bottom right, I believe, you can see that is actually a 7 foot tall papier-mâché Roosevelt Sphinx head. In 1939, Roosevelt remained coy about whether he'd run for re-election, and political cartoons often depicted him as a mysterious Sphinx. And so journalists at the 1939 Gridiron Dinner wheeled out the Sphinx head as a surprise. He loved it so much that it found a great home in his particular library. That desk at the top in the middle is the desk that he had in his Oval Office. One thing in particular, I showed you Hoover and I showed you FDR. Neither one of them had an example of their Oval Office in their library and museum, and the others have all gotten the bug. And you actually see the Oval Office in the other libraries, but not at Tuva, not at FDR. And other artifacts, that violin with FDR's head was quite unique. And I'm just showing you small snippets of what are in there. I know I have a lot of slides in this presentation, but it is so worth your while to get out there and actually see the things that our presidents have accumulated over the years. You'll see what he had done in his first 100 years. You'll see stuff that his wife has done, some of her books, some of her exhibits. That gun there was actually a weapon that was given by Abraham Lincoln to the president of Turkey, and when FDR became president, it was returned to FDR by the president of Turkey, and it's now on display in the FDR library. And you can see that's actually a picture of the t-shirt that I bought at that museum with all the programs that FDR was responsible for in his so many years. Four terms, didn't complete the fourth term, but four terms as President of the United States. The other thing that fascinates me about FDR is his Four Freedoms speech, and there are a lot of great display pieces in the library about his Four Freedoms speech. And you can also see the Four Freedoms speech is a center room at the Norman Rockwell Museum out in the Berkshires. And I know, Chris, you were out there very recently and you probably saw that. Those posters there were drawn by Norman Rockwell in response to the speech, which is freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. And he delivered that speech, probably one of the most memorable speeches. And you can see the actual speech and his handwritten remarks on the speech. And the other two pictures that are at the top left and bottom right corner are actually Four Freedoms Park in New York City. This is another one of those occasions. We went out, my son graduated from Parsons New School of Design, and His graduation exercises happened to be in Queens, New York. And so I woke up one morning, the day of the graduation. I said, hey, the graduation's not till this afternoon. Does anybody want to go for a ride with me to Four Freedoms Park? I got the same silent response that I see here, but I made that journey. It was about a half hour ride. It was raining. But it's if you look at the East River, between Manhattan and Queens, if you're driving along the Roosevelt Parkway, you can actually see this odd-shaped parcel of land in the middle of the East River, and that's Four Freedoms Park, and that also happens to be the park where Hillary Clinton announced her presidential campaign in 2015 for 2016 race. So Four Freedoms is something near and dear to my heart and definitely commemorated there. So if you do go out to Hyde Park and you do visit the FDR Library and Museum, I do urge you to stop at Val Kill. Eleanor Roosevelt didn't get along with FDR's mother, so how you handle that is you build your own house. And you build it about 5 miles away, so you don't have to run into dear mom, dear mother-in-law, when you don't need to. But she had this great house on a great parcel of land. That also, in addition to her home, also hosted Top Cottage. And if you see the signs over on the top right, that's the trail that you can walk from Eleanor's house. You climb up it's not really a mountain, but it's a fairly steep hill, and you walk up, and at the top of it, you see that little cottage. Which is in the bottom middle, and that's where FDR hosted many world leaders in a more relaxed setting when he wanted to have conversations. So that's all out in that neck of the woods. And finally, his resting place, along with the resting place of his wife, Eleanor, is right on the property, right next to the museum. So Harry S. Truman, Independence, Missouri. Great, one of my favorite places to visit, because not only do you get to see the library and museum, but you get to see his boyhood home. You get to see the home that he lived in before he became president and after he was the president. You get to go into his neighbor's house across the street, and you get to walk the streets where Harry Truman was frequently walking those streets before he became president, while he was president, and after he was president. And the library is so close to his home that he would walk to that library. He was alive when the library was being constructed. This here is the home where he lived, and you can get a tour through the house and see exactly how he lived, him and Bess Truman in that house, and actually parked in the garage. Out in the back is still his vehicle that he owned up until the day he died. It's I would assume they move it every now and then, but it's just sitting there parked in the garage, and they say it's in the same spot. Just a bit of trivia. Let's take a trivia break here. Does anybody know what the S in Harry S. Truman's name stands for? Yes, sir.
Absolutely nothing.
Bam! You win. Absolutely nothing. It was a compromise between the names of his grandfathers, Anderson Schiff Truman and Solomon Young. So S is absolutely nothing. You can pick up your prize on the way up. When you go into the museum, obviously Truman's "The Buck Stops Here" desk sign is very, very prominently displayed, and everyone associates Harry Truman with that. And it's a friend of his gave it to him in 1945, and it sat on his desk until shortly before he left office. And the original that sat on his desk, you can get an up close and personal peek at it. This is the Oval Office as he would have sat in it at the White House. They make them dimensionally correct. I think there's only one that's a little bit smaller, but you really can't tell the difference. But it's great to actually walk in and see how they put things out in their office. You can see some of the artifacts and a typical what a typical day for a president looks like. It's all spelled out on a schedule, and you get to see some of the decisions that he was involved in as the president. One of the things I want to point out to you, obviously he had the decision of whether to drop the atomic bomb in Japan, and that device that's at the top right to the right of the newspaper was the safety plug from the atomic bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki. It's only 2 inches long and an inch in diameter, but it was pulled then and inserted before the bomb was dropped. And the airman who pulled it, he put it in his pocket after he did it. And years later, he contacted the library to ask if they wanted it. And that device literally has the fingerprints of an American airman on it. And as they say, if Truman pulled the plug on the atomic age, then his fingerprints are also on that plug there. An incredible decision made by a president, and one that he's looked at for years since. He was also the first president to recognize the new Jewish state in May 15 of 1948, and he was counseled against recognizing the Jewish state so as not to antagonize the Arab states and jeopardize American access to oil. And while President Truman had a great regard for George C. Marshall, he did eventually make the decision on May 14th to recognize the new state of Israel. And that statement, recognizing Israel, on the bottom left, has the Truman's last minute handwritten changes about making that particular decision. This is life in the Truman age. It looks pretty good. We know that the 50s were roaring, but things were going pretty well in the 1940s, and you get a glimpse of life in the 1940s with this particular exhibit. And then, fascinating is that Harry S. Truman pulled off one of the biggest election surprises in history when he defeated Thomas Dewey to win the 1948 presidential election. Not one person ever thought that Truman was going to win that election, but one thing about Harry Truman, he knew how to connect to people, and his Whistle Stop campaign tour, which is commemorated here, took him across 21,000 miles to 250 cities, and he delivered a total of 300 speeches. Now, Alicia, I only took you on 1,200 miles. Imagine if you had to join me for 21,000. And as you can see, that original newspaper with Dewey defeats Truman is absolutely on display, and you can see a handwritten copy of the daily schedule that's typed out for him every single day by his staff. I see that Kobe's not here. I was going to say, how come I don't get a handwritten schedule like this laid out for me? But I guess he knew he was going to be fodder for some lines. This is some of the pieces when Truman was leaving the library, and that picture on the top left is actually a statue of Harry Truman looking out in the courtyard of his museum and library, where he actually is laid to rest with his wife. And you can see him, these are some photographs of him walking through the town of Independence, and you know, there are pathways throughout that community. If you want a reason to go to Independence, and I actually want to go back to Independence because his library and museum underwent a total renovation and redesign and was just reopened this particular summer. So I said, if the Patriots play Kansas City in a playoff game, I'm going to go to see that game, because the Truman Library is about 20 minutes from that particular stadium. So if you have anything happening in Kansas City, it's a short ride over to see Independence, Missouri. He played a hand in building this library, and you can see him right out there in that vehicle, which is parked in his garage. And that's the office that he used while he was working in the library. And I was particularly drawn to this quote. I'm a reader myself, but I saw this on the wall and thought I would share it with you. Readers of good books, particularly books of biography and history, are preparing themselves for leadership. Not all readers become leaders, but all leaders must be readers. And I will take that to my grave. And this is the grave where Harry Truman is buried. It's right in the courtyard of his particular library. Dwight D. Eisenhower's library and museum and resting place for the 34th president is located in his hometown of Abilene, Kansas. And the boyhood home, which is on that property, was where he lived from 1898 until being appointed to West Point in 1911. And at his dedication, he said that when this library is filled with documents and scholars come here to probe into some of the facts of the past half century, I hope that they, as we, are concerned primarily with the ideals, principles, and trends that provide guides to a free, rich, peaceful future in which all people can achieve ever-rising levels of human well-being. That's what he said at the opening of his library. And I think, again, that captures the essence of what these libraries are all about and why I really wanted to visit them and see them. This is the boyhood home, which is right on the property of the library, and you can see that sign of the library really has that authentic Kansas feel, and it's a unique town. There's a new show that's on HBO called Someplace Somewhere, which tracks a woman from Kansas, and Alicia, I commend it to you because we couldn't find a hotel in Abilene, Kansas. We had to stay in Manhattan, Kansas, which is a college town about 10 miles away. But the show, Somewhere, Someplace, is actually about a woman from Manhattan, Kansas. And as they were showing the scenes of that downtown, I distinctly remembered our visit out here. But it's a great place to see. This is the boyhood home, where you'll see the values that carried him through the Second World War and through his presidency. And you also know that he was a wartime general. And a lot of the things in his library are dedicated to things focused on World War II and the horrors he saw there. You actually see the table, the conference room table, where the D-Day invasion was planned. And that table is right there. You walk right up to it. But the thing that I draw your attention to in this particular slide is it's a handwritten note from Ike, and it's the "in case of failure" note. In case that invasion had failed, he wanted folks to know. So this is what the note reads. "The troops, the air, and the Navy did all that bravery and devotion to duty could do. If any blame or fault attaches to the attempt, it is mine alone." Well, we're sitting here today grateful and thankful that he never had to send that note, but you can see that note in his library. He was a great lover of automobiles, and you know him for passing the Federal Highway Act in 1956, which created 41,000 miles of roadway to connect the nation. I was amazed, as a chairman of the Energy Committee and one who deals with all things climate change, that he actually owned an electric car. And that electric car is in that library. It's a 1914 Roush and Lang electric vehicle that could travel 100 miles at 13 miles an hour. 1914. And that box, that Enigma machine, which is on the bottom right, is one of the cipher machines used by the Nazis to encode and decode sensitive information during World War II. And that was captured. And that allowed the British to decipher the code and save thousands of lives. And that machine is on display in the library. This is some of the campaign material. He did serve two terms as our president. And you get to see some of the many artifacts and pieces from that particular race. He was also very active in many areas of government that are important to us today. Healthcare, housing, education. He had served as a military leader and had seen war and had seen the hazards of war and didn't like war. And he warned us about the military-industrial complex, and that's the actual text from that particular speech on the top right. And the note in the middle is his handwritten notes having to deal with the Little Rock School that was being desegregated and what involvement the federal troops were going to have in that particular effort. He was a great seeker of peace and a crusader for peace, and he became convinced that U.S. military superiority depended on the nation's vast economic strength, and so he spent a lot of time on those endeavors that would make the United States a more prosperous nation, feeling that that would keep us out of war. And then, and later in his life, he had an office in Gettysburg that he occupied from 1961 to 1968, and this is in his library in Kansas and set up as he would have had entertained many foreign visitors at that particular site in Gettysburg. And like most of our other presidents, he's buried in a chapel, which is on the property in Abilene, Kansas, and you can see his final resting place there. Closer to home, we have the JFK Library right over in Boston. How many have been to the JFK Library? All right, that's up there. That's uplifting. It's only open on weekends right now because of the pandemic, but hoping to get back there. I am a member of that library, and anytime I find myself over in that neck of the woods, even if it's for just 30 minutes, just to walk through and take it in, I will stop in. If you become a member, you get free admission to not only the library in your hometown, but that's free admission to every single library. So a pointer for you, if you want to visit them, become a member and you will not pay an admission fee at any of the libraries. And that became particularly, and you can actually, if you get a multi-person pass, that applies to them. And I remember when Rep. Garbley and I went to the Reagan Museum, we were almost floored when they wanted $35 per ticket to get into the library, but my JFK pass and it was a family pass and got us both in there. So that's a little tip for you if you want to go visit these libraries. So before we get to the library museum, we have his boyhood home in Brookline, Massachusetts, which is still there today and is a museum run by the National Park Service. So I would urge you to get over to Brookline and see that in operation. But as you get to the JFK Library, the first thing you are associated with are his campaign for the 1960 election, and you'll see a typical campaign headquarters set up, buttons and stickers and even records of the songs from the campaign. You'll see campaign signs for the race between Kennedy and Johnson and Nixon and Lodge. And you'll see them both on the cover of Time magazine as you get there. And you'll see the studio where they conducted the first debate in presidential history. And that studio is all set up and you get a real feel for what it was like to be a part of that. And JFK is reported to be very agile on his feet in terms of having lots of facts at his command and the ability to respond. But it is said that people who listened to that debate felt that Nixon won the debate, but that he looked horrible on TV and was sweating, and that really gave it to JFK. But that's just a glimpse at the studio. My favorite exhibit in this library, of course, is the inaugural address that he gave in January 20th, 1961, and the memorable line about ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. That's a slogan and sign that hung on my bedroom wall as a little kid, still hangs on my wall in my office to this day. Very inspiring words, and really, I think, uplifted a nation that needed to be uplifted and led a lot of folks into public service as a result. This is a glimpse. First you do the campaign, but then you actually walk into what looks like the White House, and you begin to see many of the exhibits from his time as the president. I love to show folks the Kennedy rocker that was in his Oval Office. Actually, there was one in LBJ's Oval Office, and I'll show you why it's meaningful to me a little bit later in this presentation. You see some of the artifacts from many of the visits. That's Pablo Casals performing at the White House. I was a cello player in my youth, and as a matter of fact, I was showing to Jim Johnston this particular 1978 National Christmas Pageant of Peace. I was no Pablo Casals, but I played my cello on the White House lawn in 1978 for President Carter. You also see the cover from the original Profiles in Coverage, Profiles in Courage, which is a great book on leadership. Henry, I would suggest that's a book you want to read at some point very near in your future. You get to see some real courageous and difficult decisions that people had made. But the picture up on the top left is one that I call your attention to. That's the last speech that JFK gave, and that was at the dedication of the Frost Library at Amherst College. And why I call that to your attention, in the middle I put this book, JFK, The Last Speech, and it was written by students from Amherst College just a few years ago, reflecting on what that speech meant to them and how it made such a difference in their lives and the decisions about what they were going to do with their lives. And here they were reflecting 50 years later on what they did with their lives. It's a fascinating story, fascinating book, and I commend that for your reading. The picture with Eleanor Roosevelt was actually taken from one of the rooms at Val Kill. JFK knew you want to succeed in life, you go visit Eleanor at Val Kill. That's right from that place. And the coconut on the bottom right is when JFK's PT-109 boat was hit and he was lost on an island. He actually carved out a message on that coconut and gave it to folks, and that was what they used to come and rescue him. And the villagers who had that coconut actually gave it to the president, and it's now in the library. And he actually had paperweights made of them, and you can put one on your desk if you'd like. Of course, JFK had his table at the Union Oyster House in Boston, and I felt it was my duty and responsibility to have a meal there, and that's with my lovely wife and some of her friends who made arrangements for us to have lunch at the Union Oyster House at the Kennedy booth, so another place I would urge you to visit. And of course, JFK is not buried in Boston. He's buried at Arlington National Cemetery in Washington, D.C., and that's a glimpse at his final resting place. We move up to LBJ, and like the Truman Library, you really get a feel for LBJ and his life by visiting this library. But not only the library, when Alicia and I were in the bookstore, one of the folks who works there said, are you guys going to the ranch? And I had promised Alicia that we would spend 6 days on the road, and our final day would be in the city of Austin, which is a great city for music, and we would spend the day enjoying the music in Austin. And so we were having this conversation, and I said, well, where is the ranch? She said, well, it's about 100 miles from here. It's in Johnson City, Texas. She said, but it's very well worth it. So I looked at Alicia and I said, I'm going to leave this as your choice. Do you want to go to the ranch? And what was your response, Alicia?
We went to the ranch.
The way she looked at it was, Dad, I know you. If we don't go to the ranch, I will hear about this for the rest of my life. That's the LBJ Library. It's the biggest of all, and LBJ was larger than life. Well, why shouldn't his library be larger than life? That's a 10-story high building on the campus of the University of Austin at Texas, and it. I'm standing, that picture of the football stadium is taken from that that perch up on the 10th floor. So he was right on the middle of the campus. And that tower that you can see from the grounds of the library is where the mass shooting in Austin, Texas took place in the 60s when there was a gentleman with a rifle at the top of the tower firing. That was the beginning of some horrific conduct that happens with these mass shootings. But the first thing you're greeted with when you walk into this library is the signing of the Civil Rights Act in 1964. And, you know, really symbolizes what LBJ was all about and his ability to get things done. And one of the things I can share with you is that he was a great user of these signing ceremonies, and I think he really changed the symbolism of signing ceremonies and handing out pens at the signing ceremonies. Indeed, right next to that picture, this is right to the right of that civil rights picture, samples of all of the pens that LBJ used. So a president used a pen that said President White House, and it was a simple looking pen. But LBJ came up with the clever idea of getting fancy pens and putting his name on the pen and handing them out as gifts to people who were there at the signing ceremonies. He handed out 72 pens in the signing of the Civil Rights Act. The first one was to Senator Everett Dirksen, a Republican, without whose support the bill would not have passed. And one of the other things that I will suggest to you that you could see plain from the LBJ Library was the ability of Democrats and Republicans to work together, and his ability to do that. And I hope we get back to that point. We're there in Massachusetts. I can tell you Republicans and Democrats work together extremely well in Massachusetts, but not so much on a national level. But that wasn't the case back in LBJ's time. The other memorable artifact that was in that museum is the pedestal that was in the United States Congress. I had often wondered, because I had seen this, the FDR speech on December 7th, this day will live in infamy, and I said, boy, that's taken from the House of Representatives, but it doesn't look like that today. I wonder where that is. Well, it's down in Austin, Texas, in the LBJ Library, sitting on display, as shown in the upper right. And I also loved that quote there. Let's go back here. Let's do this right. I love this quote. If one morning I walked up top of the water across the Potomac River, the headline that afternoon would read, "The president can't swim." He didn't have a great relationship with the press, and that exemplifies it. This is also one of the few libraries and museums that you can actually see the books and papers on display. So as you're walking in the entrance to the library, all those red covered volumes are all of the books and papers on display on the library. I will say that the most daunting of the exhibits is seeing this small Catholic missal upon which LBJ swore the oath of office aboard Air Force One on November 22nd of 1963 after President Kennedy's assassination. That missal belonged to Kennedy, and he had left it aboard the plane before disembarking in Dallas. And it ends up in this particular library. And that significant speech, "Let us continue," I'll see if I can say it like LBJ, "Let us continue," is his handwritten notes, making some changes, knowing how important that speech was to the people of the United States, and knowing that he was about to undertake a task that I wouldn't wish upon any other human being. It's amazing to see these symbols on display for you to see. He was also probably the most productive president of any. Over 1,000 pieces of legislation bear his signature and his name. I actually do have a pen, and this is one of the pens used by President LBJ on September 9th, 1966. In signing S-3005, an act to provide for a coordinated national safety program and establishment of safety standards for motor vehicles and interstate commerce to reduce accidents involving motor vehicles and reduce the deaths and injuries occurring in such accidents. And that's, I see how these things work, because I have many pens in my office, and so when the governor, and I'm certain LBJ had three names, so he could really do this. So they'll make a little L, and then take that pen, hand it to somebody, make the Y, and so on and so forth. So that's how you can all get a pen. Isn't that how it goes, Rep. Gobley? And he was so productive in so many areas of life. If you think of things that you value today, you can thank LBJ for many of them. And again, these are some of the pens that he used. That's the desk that he was actually sitting at when he signed the Civil Rights Act. And that's another one of my t-shirts that I got from that library, which speaks about all of the areas that he was involved in governing. This again is his Oval Office. This one happens to be up on the 10th floor of the building, but he found such great comfort in that Kennedy rocker that he kept it, and he had one in his office as well. My favorite is LBJ's powers for being persuasive and dispensing that power which, with what has become known as the Johnson treatment. The photograph to the right is soon to become Justice Abe Fortas of the United States Supreme Court. But LBJ would use his imposing physical size and intimidating personality to emphasize the point. And the treatment could last anywhere from 10 minutes or 4 hours, and it would come whenever and wherever Johnson might find a fellow senator or politician within his radius. So, and that's me getting the Johnson treatment. If you go down there, you can get the Johnson treatment as well. Some other things, again, this is another nice baseball signed by Babe Ruth and a lot of other players from the 1930s. And that's a letter from the Smothers Brothers. How many remembers the Smothers Brothers? All right, well, this is a rich crowd. They sent a letter apologizing to them to making some untoward jokes about LBJ on their show, and it was interesting to see that letter there. This is the exhibit on him deciding that he would not accept, nor would he seek, the nomination in 1968. In Vietnam, as productive as he was as a president on the domestic front, he just could not overcome Vietnam and made the decision not to run again. But here's our great visit to the ranch. That 100 miles was worth the journey. He actually had an airport and a runway on the ranch, and you can see Air Force One Half is on the property in a hangar. It's a real farm with cows and deer running around the farm. And that's Alicia in front of the Johnson City sign at the culmination of our additional 100-mile journey. And LBJ not only liked to give away pens, but he loved to give away gifts. And as you walk into the hangar at the airport, you walk into what looks like a little store. And that's where he would bring his guests who were visiting him. And depending on the quality of the guest, that would depend on the quality of the gift that you would get. That could be a Stetson hat, which are over on the right-hand side. You could get jackets, you could get boots, you could get watches, you could get pens, you could get lighters. All of those gifts, it's like stepping back in time. The stuff is still there, sitting on the shelves. And this is the Texas White House in the ranch where he lived with Lady Bird. And Lady Bird lived there well into the 2000s. And after she passed, she turned the property over to the US government. And it's now a living museum that you can go visit. And I can remember, now my memory's becoming clearer as LBJ is in office, and I can remember those scenes from Life magazine of him in the swimming pool, which you can walk right by on the property, and I can remember him lifting his beagles by their ears. And this all took place at this ranch down in Johnson City. And this, I have to get a picture in front of the Texas White House, but this vehicle was probably the most entertaining portion. So he liked to joke, and there's a great scene if you watch the LBJ movie with Bryan Cranston. There's a scene where he's driving Hubert Humphrey across the property, and he's driving towards the river, and he says, "The brakes are failing, the brakes are not working." And Hubert Humphrey is stone cold, crazed, and all of a sudden the car drives in the water, but it's an amphibious vehicle. And he loved to pull that trick on people, and that car sits in the garage at his particular museum. As you leave the ranch, you can see where LBJ and all of his family members are buried, but also you can see the one-room schoolhouse where he attended. That actually is on the property of his family ranch. And he was so dedicated to education that he brought his first teacher to that schoolhouse to sign one of his first education bills as the president. And that, in that picture, you see him, I'm a little fast here. You see him seated next to his first grade teacher signing that bill. He really knew how to use the power of the office and the ceremony. Richard Nixon, you know, my memory is becoming clearer. I'm now getting into my teens, and you know, he becomes the president in 1968, I was amazed at how well put together this particular museum was, and what it offered. I mean, it's you walk in and it's a beautiful setup. You can see the exhibit up on the top right is the I can't remember the name of the town, San Clemente, which no longer exists. Rep Gavely and I looked feverishly for it, but it apparently has been torn down. But that's where he would do his summer White House meetings, and this is the entrance way when you get into the particular museum. And he takes the presidency at a time of great turmoil. The 60s are just really changing the landscape in America, and he takes the helm at that time. And you can see you know, some of the memorabilia. That first debate is also on display in his particular library. But this is here, believe it or not, this is the most requested item of all time from the National Archives. It's the photo of President Nixon and Elvis Presley shaking hands during Presley's visit to the White House in 1970. There's actually a movie about this visit, because Elvis Presley actually handwrote a letter to the president. It's 6 pages. You can see the first page of that letter. He wanted to be a deputy for President Nixon, and he actually brought a gun with him to this visit. Secret Service was not thrilled with the idea of him bringing a gun. But that, folks, you're looking to, is the most requested item from the National Archives. You get to glimpse at his domestic policy. He was an unbelievable note taker, and all of his notes are there. His is probably the most preserved presidency, with all of the taping that was done, for good or bad. But it's there, it's available, you can listen to it. You can also visit his Oval Office, which is set up exactly how he had it. And yes, I enjoyed the opportunity to sit at the desk, not something that's offered at every single library, but they certainly did it at Nixon's library. You also get to dive into the China initiative that he was involved in, and there's a whole room dedicated to that particular trip. But this is, I think, what we all remember Richard Nixon for. And I recall growing up and my father saying, pay close attention to these hearings that are going on. It may be boring to you, but this is going to be history someday, and pay attention to it. And pay attention I did, and I can tell you, as a 13-year-old kid, I wondered whether our government would be around and whether our government would survive this constitutional crisis. And it certainly worried me. It's an issue that's handled very well at the Nixon Library. It wasn't handled well, and I think that was one of the issues why the National Archives would not take over the running of this library, because they weren't handling it well. They did change their ways, and then the National Archives took it over. But they don't shy away from that particular issue. And then this is the speech that I remember to this day. And in fact, I have a copy of this speech on my iPhone. I have it on my iPad, and I watch it on occasion, because it shows a leader who was the most powerful person in the world, and how he had fallen from grace and was delivering what I would say is probably the most emotional and humbling speech that anyone had to ever deliver as a world leader. And you know, he took his lumps and he walked away from the office, but that speech, if you read it, is loaded with sentence fragments. It doesn't seem to make much sense when you read it, but when you watch it and you listen to it, your heart just feels for the man, feels for the family, feels for the nation, feels for the staff, everybody who was in that particular room. If you haven't seen it, I commend that. It's about 13 minutes long. And some other artifacts that are on display. I'm sure you've seen those before. But one of them shows him in his room taking copious notes, which is something that he did quite often. And of course, he's buried on the property as well. And that home right near his final resting place happens to be his boyhood home, which they moved onto the property of his library and museum. So Gerald Ford is the was the last of my presidential libraries to visit, and that occurred in September of 2021. It was supposed to take place in May of 2020, but I don't know, I can see from the masks that you're probably aware of the pandemic, so I don't have to tell you, but in May of 2020, that library shut down, so I rescheduled the visit for August of 2020, and it was still closed, so I rescheduled it for December of 2020, and then I finally got the message, this thing ain't going away anytime soon, so I did not get there until September 2nd of 2021, and that was an incredible ordeal. One of the things you get upon completion of all of the presidential libraries is a gift. So you have to present your passport, which you bring to all of the libraries, and you have them stamped, and at the completion of your journey, you present it to the library folks, and they will present you with a gift. And Rep. Gobley was by my side as I turned in my passport and got it stamped for the final time and heard the gentleman say to me, "Sir, I have no idea what you're talking about." So we went through the library, and we had our great fun, and it was a little depressing. I've been on this journey for about 6 years, and it came to a screaming halt, but it was great walking through the library. This is what the library looks like. I stayed in the hotel right across the street. This was my big moment, and I could not have been more excited. It's a beautiful location right on the Grand River in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And these are my great colleagues who have heard about these journeys so much that they decided for my last one they wanted to be there with me. That's Rep. Kevin Honan from Brighton, Rep. Gobley from Arlington, who's in the back of the room, and Rep. Gregoire from the great city of Marlboro. They enjoyed joining me on the journey and counseled me when my gift was not available. So, not one to be rejected, I wrote to the, I emailed the library director, because they told me the only people who are working post-COVID are security forces, and no employees from the federal government are on site. But I located one, sent him an email, and said, "My God," I said, "I'm at the end of my journey, and I just want something to remember about." So he didn't get back to me until we had left the next morning, and we're driving down the highway on our way to back to the airport in Detroit. And so we're about an hour out of Grand Rapids, and I get a call from the director. He said, "Mr. Roy, I have your gift, and if you come by the library, I'd be happy to give it to you." I said, "Well, Mr. Westfall, I'm about an hour outside of Grand Rapids, and if I ask my friends and colleagues to turn around, they will probably just throw me out of the car and make me walk back." So in any event, it was mailed to me, and here is the seal to commemorate the visit to the Key Library. Got it off my chest. So President Ford was the only president to be an Eagle Scout, and you can see his Eagle Scout sash. I like to tell young folks who I go to very many Eagle Scout ceremonies, I shared that with him. He was also a member of the Kennedy Assassination Commission, and you can see his desks and artifacts as a lawyer and as a congressman on display there as well. And some of the artifacts, including the tools from the Watergate break-in that got him into this office. And this is the one thing that I really wanted to see. As you can see, I love pens. So this is the pen that was used to sign the proclamation pardoning Richard Nixon, which turned out to be a profile in courage and something that he was honored for. The significance to me is it occurred on my 13th birthday. And I said, I want to see what was happening on my 13th birthday in 1974, and there it was. He was also one who faced an assassination attempt, and you can see the gun used by Squeaky Frome and the indictment charging her with the assassination attempt on display in the library. And of course, the Oval Office that Gerald Ford used is on display in his library and museum as well. Some of the issues that he had faced while he was president, in the middle bottom photo, you can see the staircase was that was on the top of the United States Embassy in Saigon when the city fell to the North Vietnamese in April 1975. And it's believed that six or 7,000 people went up that staircase to freedom. And that's a part of his particular library. I was also intrigued that he was very heavily involved in energy in 1975 and 1976 for the country. I couldn't leave without showing you Benjamin Franklin made his display in the Ford Library. That's actually a gift that was given to Gerald Ford by, I believe it's Justice Rehnquist. One of the Supreme Court justices gave that gift to President Ford. The cabinet room that he used while in Washington, D.C. is replicated in his particular museum, and his final resting place is right next to the library and museum as well. One difference between his museum and his library is that the library with his books and records is 130 miles away in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And yes, trustee team did drive all the way out to Ann Arbor to see that library, and only to be greeted at the door by a sign that said, "This library is closed." So I actually stuck my camera lens right up to the window so I could capture these photographs from what it looks like in there, but we didn't waste the moment. We did get over to the Michigan football stadium, which was a second place runner-up to a great trip out there. So Jimmy Carter was a great visit down in Atlanta. I think you know, seeing him become president, the governor of Georgia, and rising up to become the president of the United States, I uniquely share the folks that I took this journey with. I was at an opioid conference down in Atlanta with the folks from the SAFE Coalition. And I said, "Hey guys, I have this crazy hobby. Would you like to join me on a visit?" And so they accompanied me to the Carter Museum. What I really wanted to see at that museum is that solar panel on the right. Jimmy Carter had installed solar panels on the West Wing. back in 1979. And when Ronald Reagan came in, one of the first things he did do was to remove those solar panels from the roof. I just can't help but think where the technology would be today had we furthered development of solar technology. But that panel that was removed from the roof is sitting down in Atlanta. You can see things from his campaigns earlier in his life and speeches that he made. And of course, the Oval Office that he sat in while he was the President of the United States. Memorable things, his work globally with peace between Egypt and Israel is commemorated. As we know, there were troubles with the hostages, and that is dealt with in his particular museum. He's not known for having a great presidency, but he's well known for his work, probably the greatest ex-president we have ever had. And he works to this day on global issues. And the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to Jimmy Carter in 2002 for his work in international diplomacy and human rights, and he's one of only four presidents to win the Nobel Prize. The others were Theodore Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, and Barack Obama. Interesting, and this is from that book talk that Peter Ross Range gave. He's a reporter from the Washington Post. It was just fascinating to meet him down there. One of the things that you ought to know, and you may already know, is that Jimmy Carter, up until last year, continued to teach Sunday school in Plains, Georgia. And library and museum visits wouldn't be complete without a trip to Plains, Georgia to see the President of the United States teach Sunday school. And I did that in January of 2019. I was telling some of the folks beforehand how this all works is they publish a schedule as to when he's going to be offering Sunday school, and you make your arrangements to go down there, and you hope to hell that not something doesn't happen, and he shows up. And so we made the journey down in January of 2019, knowing he was going to be there. Advice was to get into the parking lot at the church by 4 a.m., and as you pull in, that's us pulling, the top left is us pulling into the parking lot in darkness. Rep Gobbly did not want to be in the car with us. He wanted to get his own number. So he stepped out of his car and he walked up to the gentleman at the gate and said, "I took an Uber." And the guy looks, "We have Uber in Plains, Georgia?" So he was number 53, and me and Representative Honan were number 54. You go and you park your car in the church parking lot, and they recommend that you try to sleep comfortably for about 3 or 4 hours, because you're not going to get in line till about 7:30 in the morning. Then you get in line, and that's us folks getting in line to see the president. You have to go through Secret Service. The service itself starts at 9 a.m. And as we're sitting there waiting for President Carter to walk in, I see two gentlemen walk into the chapel, and I said to my colleagues, I said, "That looks like Cory Booker and John Lewis." And they said, "Yeah, I think you're right." So we walked up, much to the chagrin of the church lady who runs things there. She said, "This is a church service, you are not to be running around." And I said, "Well, we just want to say hello to these great men." And she said, "All right, go say hello, get your picture, and then get back to your seat." Cory Booker, who had the long arms, was only too kind enough to do a selfie with us. And that's something that will remain special, given the passing of John Lewis, to meet them. And I said to them, "Well, what are you guys doing here?" And they said, "We're here for the exact same reason you are, to see the President of the United States teach Sunday school." I said, "So you're not part of the program?" They said, "No, we are here for the same reason you are." And I can tell you, that was probably one of the most incredible experiences I had, to be sitting in a room and take a lesson from the president. I've actually posted the entire Sunday school service on YouTube. And if anybody would like to see that, it's about 45 minutes long. I'd be happy to send you the link. And of course, after you leave the church, you go downtown to Plains, And Jimmy Cotter is the draw for Plains. I don't know what's going to happen to that town when he's gone, but they have this great political memorabilia store that we went into. His original campaign headquarters is there. Billy Cotter's gas station is there. Jimmy Cotter's high school is there. His boyhood home is there. And yes, Billy Bear is on sale. How much are they looking for that beer there? I just remember it was an untidy sum of $90 for a six pack of beer that you're never gonna drink. Those cans were full. But you can buy that down at the Carter Museum. Let's move on to Ronald Reagan. And Ronald Reagan is out in Simi Valley, California, and probably the most beautiful grounds for a presidential library, because we literally had to climb a mountain in Simi Valley, California, to get to that particular museum. You can see this is the outside and the entrance as you get in. One of the most compelling pieces that was of great interest to me was this photograph on the top left, which is note cards that he had kept with great quotes that he liked to use in his speeches. They're all in his own handwriting and coded and put out on display. Just incredible the work that he would do with those types of things. And his campaign, Reagan and Bush, and that famous line from one of the debates, "Are you better off than you were 4 years ago?" All of that, and the cue cards that he would use for his speeches. He had his own method for writing down the comments that he would use in his speeches, and those are on display as well. His incredible optimism is something that I take and enjoyed about his presidency. Why I may not agree with him on many of his policies, I do agree with his belief in America and his optimism and his belief and the American spirit, and it's captured by these two items that were on his desk. It can be done, and no limit to what you can do if you're not concerned about who's going to get the credit. Took careful note of those. His assassination attempt in 1981 is clear as day, and the artifacts from that particular event are on display, and it's amazing how close he came to being killed. We really didn't know that at the time, but we know as of today that he came perilously close to dying. His Oval Office is also on display and captures the character of his personality. He kept diaries, and those diaries are on display in the museum and in his own handwriting, and you can see how detailed he was in keeping those diaries. Some of the tidbits that are there, and these are all digitized if you want to read them, but you can find tidbits on Jack Lemmon, who refers to him as a truly great performer, Mikhail Gorbachev, his response to my letter was arrogant, I'm mad as hell, and the assassination attempt, he writes, getting shot hurts. panel on the, or the photograph on the right is the effort of Just Say No to Drugs that was championed by Nancy Reagan, and all of the materials is on display at that particular library. One of the amazing things is the Boeing 707 that he used as Air Force One. Reagan used it and six other presidents, and that plane is actually in the museum, and you can walk through it. It's been restored to mint condition. You can see Reagan's jacket on the plane, authentic briefing books, and a fake chocolate cake, because Reagan insisted on always having a cake on board in case someone had a birthday. These are the grounds of the library, and you can see this picture on the bottom, and it probably doesn't jump out at you as clearly, but when we had visited in November of 2019, the wildfires in California had become so close. All of that land So this is green grass here, but all of that land was burnt. And folks had run to try and save the library and museum from the fire because they came dangerously close to destroying that facility. This photograph on the top center is an interesting woman who we happened to bump into while there and carrying a monkey and taking pictures with this stuffed monkey. Apparently that's her national pastime, and I thought I had weird hobbies. Her national pastime is to take pictures and post them on a Facebook page of her and her monkey at different places, and she was posing with the monkey at the Reagan Library, and she was kind enough to pose for a photo with me. So I hope I wasn't the monkey, but it was fun. Some of the international work that he did, the collapsing of the Berlin Wall really began with him, and the speech where he asks Mikhail Gorbachev to tear down that wall, the text of it that he was reading from is on display in that library. I was fascinated by this picture by Norman Rockwell, which really captures the essence of his demeanor. Very well, and you can see him meeting the artist. What I really call to your attention here is the note that he wrote to Americans when he learned that he had Alzheimer's disease. It's a very touching note, and to hear him issuing his goodbye and to read it is very touching. I would urge you to take a peek at that when you get a chance. Oop, there they go. Back on track. So his final resting place is on the side of this mountain, and you can obviously see it's glorious. We happened to catch a sunset while we were there, and his final resting place is right there in the side of the mountain. George Bush. The first George Bush is down in College Station, Texas, also on the campus of the University of Texas, and follows that similar theme of introducing to you to his earlier life and his military career. I couldn't help but capture this photograph. This is showing when he had crashed in his plane. He survived, but others didn't. About a year after, or actually a month after this particular visit to the museum, I went to San Diego where I was at a conference, and they had us go to a aircraft carrier, which is now a museum, out in San Diego. And I walked up to this plane that was the same plane I had seen in the Bush Library a month before, and I just was standing there and said, "This is amazing." And this voice from behind me said, "Yeah, it's pretty neat, isn't it?" And I turned around, and that was Jeb Bush standing there. And I said, "Governor," I said, "if you don't mind, I'd love to get a picture with you in front of your dad's plane, the Barber 3, named after his mother." And he said, "Yeah," he said, that's good." He said, "But if I take a picture with you, all of a sudden, all these other people here are going to want a picture with me." And I said, "Governor, that's your problem. I need the picture." So he complied, and sure enough, a line assembled, and I said, "Have a nice evening." But it also talks about, George Bush's life as a congressman, and, he was one to urge President Nixon to resign, and you can see some of the memorabilia from there. In his campaign with Ronald Reagan to be the Vice President of the United States, and moving on to his own inauguration. And I certainly remember that race very well. In fact, I have up here my Dukakis cigarettes from 1988. They're unopened. I'm not a smoker, but I still thought it was a unique thing, and happened to see the great Governor Michael Dukakis on the steps of the stairhouse. State House stairway, and affectionately asked him could I please get a picture with you? It wasn't the enormous lines that were there for Jeb Bush, but he complied, and I think it fits in well with what we're looking at today. The Berlin Wall actually did come down during his presidency, and that's obviously on display along with his office from Camp David, which is shown. And his Oval Office is on display, and that baseball glove is from his years at Yale University as a baseball player, and he kept that in his desk in the Oval Office. This is a door that was given to him by the people of Kuwait in thanks for the work that he had done in the war. And it's on display there along with some of the other pieces. He was only president for 4 years, but he had been through much in his time as the president. This is the 1992 election with Clinton and Gore, and what I want to call to your attention here is the letter that George Bush had written to Bill Clinton. It's a tradition for the president to leave a letter for the incoming president, and it's probably one of the kindest and most wonderful things that you can do to an incoming president, to give that person your support and stand behind them. And it's just a great read. I would commend that for your reading as well. He's also known as for the president with 1,000 points of light, and there's a great painting there commemorating that, and also one of the many parachutes that he used. He loved to jump out of planes and did that well into his 90s. He was still living when I was at that library, but this is where his final resting place is today. Clinton Library has yet another great story because we went to the Clinton Library in January of 2019, and similar to the note that we saw on the Ford Library, we were the government was shut down in January of 2019, and as we walked to the door of the Clinton Library, we saw the note on the door that this facility is closed. And as one who journeys on these, again, taking no for an answer is not something I can easily wrestle with. So we figured out a way to get into the building, and we got into the lobby. We could go to the restaurant. We could see some of the artifacts in the lobby. I was able to get my stamp on my passport, and we found an elevator. We took it up to try and see the Oval Office and got in there, but that door was locked, and we didn't want to push our luck, but we did get to see much of what that library is about. And I ended up buying, and up on the table here is they actually have a book that takes you through the library. So my tour of the Clinton Library is all on paper, and you can see what I saw by looking at this book. I will get back to Little Rock, I can assure you. But it's designed as a bridge to the 21st century. So if you look at the museum of itself, it actually extends out as if it's going over the Arkansas River, which is right next door to the library. And those are some of the artifacts that we were able to see. And outside is the Anne Frank tree that they are raising money to support human rights and social justice, continuing that effort. So you don't want to take a trip to Little Rock and see absolutely nothing. So we made the best of it, and we ventured over to Doe's Eat Place, which is where the Clinton campaign would have many of their meetings. It looks like a rather seedy joint if you look at this photograph, and we actually thought that the folks who had given us directions there were playing a joke on us to say this is where they sent us. It was not a pleasant place, but once we got inside, we saw it was a great place to have a steak, and the steak there is served family style. So a huge piece of meat is plopped in front of you, and you cut it up among your friends that are there, and you can see my colleagues are with me enjoying it, and there's a lot of presidential memorabilia, including a letter from John Kerry, hanging up on the wall of that particular restaurant. And then we went on over to the Arkansas State Capitol, and just as I get to the door, they said, "I'm sorry, the place is closed." So I pull out my card. I said, "Look, and I'm here with four representatives from the Massachusetts Great and General Court, and we're only here for another couple of hours, and we would like nothing more than to see the State House of the state of Arkansas. Can we please come in?" And Southern Charm, they said, "Come on in." So we walked around, and of course, everything was closed. We walked by a door, and we could hear some laughing, and we said, "That sounds like a friendly crowd." Knocked on the door, and two of the staff members who work in the building happened to be there, and they were nothing but delightful and said, "Come on in," took us into the house chamber, turned all the lights on, gave us a tour of the building, and you can see that's the folks from the Arkansas State House there, and that's it. That's what it looks like at night. So Little Rock wasn't a complete loss, but I still will get back there. And this is the last of the presidential libraries. You know, it seems like a long time ago. George W. Bush was the president from 2000 to 2008, but that's how long it takes to get these libraries up and running. And I loved this picture. This is the only picture in the slideshow that I did not take, because I was not there. But it just was so impressive to me to see all of the sitting presidents there welcoming and being a part of the opening of their colleagues' presidential library. There's a great book called The President's Club, and it's a unique club that only former presidents sit in, but they have a real camaraderie that they have developed over the years. And as you walk in, it begins to give you chapter and verse about George W. Bush's early life and his rise. Of course, that display to the right is the famous Hanging Chads, and there's a whole display and permanent exhibit on the election of 2000, which ended up going to the U.S. Supreme Court, but not to be missed. Also, his work with the No Child Left Behind Act and his work with Senator Ted Kennedy to get that passed is commemorated there. And yes, indeed, that pen, George Bush used liked to use Sharpies. I do have a Sharpie from George Bush that I did make sure I got my hands on. It's not as elegant as the other pens that the other presidents used, but I'll leave it at that. Of course, 9/11 did happen on his watch, and there is a display there on 9/11, which includes the bullhorn that President Bush had used when he was in New York, and that's an iconic exhibit, and a lot of people like to see that. There's also a 22-foot tall twisted charred steel beam from the World Trade Center that is on display there. Some of the artifacts from the Iraq War includes the 9mm Glock pistol that was captured from Saddam Hussein when the American troops found him in 2003, and that weapon was discovered by Delta Force special troops when they dug Hussein out of the foxhole in December of 2003, and the soldiers who dug it out gave it as a gift to the president, which he viewed as his most prized possession, and it's now on display in his library. And I'm taking a little comfort in the Oval Office at his library in Dallas. And of course, you get the family photo. If you see the Christmas card next year, you might see this on that. This is a spoiler for you. And his post-presidency, and most of them go on to establish foundations and do work, and the beginning of those efforts is set out in these scenes from his library. The next library that will be open will be the Obama Library. The groundbreaking was in August of 2021. It takes a couple of years to get them up and running, but this is what his library and museum will look like. And it's down in Hyde Park, which is south of Chicago, and you can see the Chicago skyline on the right-hand side. So I would say there were some great lessons learned on this journey. This is one of my favorite photos. This is John F. Kennedy speaking on the floor of the Massachusetts House of Representatives on January 9th of 1961. We have a commemorative plaque from that speech, which was a city on a hill speech, really inspiring and informative about the work that we do as a legislator. And this is what my desk looks like at my office. Not as the neatest one in the world, but this is what I have in my office. And thanks to the good folks here at the Franklin Historical Museum, I have this beautiful display case in which I can share some of the highlights of Franklin and Medway in a box, and some of the things that have inspired me in my work. I do have the buck stops here on my desk. I have the statement from Ronald Reagan that there is no limit to what a man can do or where he can go. If he doesn't mind, who gets the credit? I can tell you, in my business, that's a huge statement, because people are starving for credit and recognition in the business, and you have to put your ego to the side. You say, if you want to get something good done, don't care about who gets the credit. Just stay on course to get it done. I have a pin collection of every pin. I collect lapel pins everywhere I go, and that particular display is every presidential site that I have been to with pins from that. And yes, that is an authentic Kennedy rocker that sits in my office, and that's where I will sit when I take meetings with folks. And I think it's patently obvious when you walk into my office that that's my seat. But there was one occasion when I walked in for a meeting and somebody was sitting in my seat. And I was like, how do I politely get that person out of my seat? But it's only happened once. I let it go. But I think now when people set up folks in my office, they either have me going first or they put something on it so that somebody doesn't sit it. But it's a great chair. It's comfortable. It's good if you have back pain, and it's a way to just be comfortable as you're meeting with folks. And I do put pens on display, and those are some of the bills that I have worked on, and I put them on display in the office along with the pen that the governor used to sign them. If you're interested in learning more about presidential libraries, there are some books out there. I'm hoping that someday I'll have the time and energy to write my own book about this journey, but there are some books already out there, some that are critical of what we do with these libraries and some that are loving what we do with these libraries. I guess it's to each his own on what they're going to do. So get yourself a passport. Go to the National Archives website. They'll give you all the information you need to get to these libraries, and please achieve to reach that goal, that seal of the presidential seal, which is crystal, which is great. And if you can't get out to some of these places and you want to know what presidents have done in your neighborhood, there's an app for your iPhone called Roadside Presidents. And it will take your geographical location and tell you what presidential items of notoriety are around you, and these happen to be some of the things that are near Franklin, Massachusetts. I think the closest one is in Woonsocket, you know, you can do that. My next road trip, I do plan to hit every presidential site other than libraries and museums, and this is a site that I've been planning for a couple of years. As soon as the pandemic is over, this is 8 presidential sites in the state of Ohio, beginning at Cincinnati and working my way up to Cleveland. I will do that. That's a 526-mile journey. Alicia, is your hand up? You going? I'd love to join anybody who would like to join. I would love to see that. But thank you so much. I know this was long, but I appreciate your attention.
Somebody once told me when I did a presentation, fanny fatigue. So in just a minute, you can stand up and stretch. but that was amazing. It was obvious what your passion for history and leadership. Just a couple of things. We'll get you another display case so your desk can look a little bit neater. There was one of the presidents who you said was on the school committee, and then the town council,
yes.
And then was a state representative.
Yes.
And then continued on to be the president.
Uh-huh.
You heard it here, folks. And before Jeff leaves, I'm going to get him a pen from the Historic Commission. So thank you all very much. Stand up, stretch, and come and look at a few of Jeff's things. And thank you all very much for coming to the museum. Our gift shop is open. Have a quick look around. And hopefully you'll find something for your sweetheart.
We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tintype Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. And by the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.